This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick.
We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past. The turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 840.MK1009, certificate number 27256. No fault divorce.
I don't understand.
Well, the problem is that your mommy and I both want you to live with us, see? So that's why we decided to go see this man who I told you is the judge, and we let him decide because he's very wise and experienced about these things. See, we talked to him for a few days, and after that we asked him what he thought. You know what he said? He agreed with Mommy. He thought it would be a terrific idea if you move in with her and live there from now on. And I'm really lucky because I get to have dinner with you once a week. And two times a month, we spend the weekends together.
Your parents are still married.
They are. 50 years? No, that's not quite true.
Seems like if they'd had their 50-year anniversary that you would remember it.
I'm just wondering when it's coming up. Let me do the math. I'm illegitimate, so I'm 40.
Right. No, I'm just kidding. Could have been.
They are just a few years away from their 50th.
And is the 50-year anniversary like the gold anniversary? You're going to have to chip in some big dollars to their present, right?
No.
It's not paper anymore.
I think the couple needs to give themselves the gift.
Oh, sure. You buy it for one another.
I don't need to buy them an anniversary gift. Do my kids... when's the last time your kids gave you any kind of...
I've never had a significant anniversary, except every year in December, I have my sobriety anniversary.
Do you get a chip from your family?
No, not from my family. For a while, like I had friends that would give me gifts. Sean Nelson used to give me a really nice Zippo every year on my AA birthday. But everyone has forgotten what my birthday is, and now it's not. But this will be my 25th year.
Of sobriety?
25 years.
That's and what day is it in December?
Well, I'm not going to tell the futurelings. It's not important to them. They're all in the future.
Will you tell me later?
Yeah, maybe I'll tell you later.
Okay.
Did you know any kids growing up who were the products of divorce, or were you kind of insulated from that?
Being overseas insulated me a lot because, you know, if you take your family overseas, you're doing it because your marriage is stable,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like, you're going to break up after you get home or before you leave, and then you won't go at all. I feel like when I was living here in Seattle, I had a few kids whose parents were divorced, and in the late 70s, that was still kind of an oddity.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it happened only, it's something that happened only in like kind of this more serious Judy Blumey kind of children's book.
Right. It was still super unusual and somewhat shocking or scandalous.
Yeah. It seemed like a thing you'd have to, you know, a kid would have to admit.
Even into the 80s, you know, I lived in a neighborhood that was largely Catholic. And my mother was the only single mom anyone could think of.
Really? Anyone knew.
Not just the only single mom, the only divorced woman. And she was absolutely discriminated against by my friend's parents. She didn't get invited to any of the potlucks.
This seems like the plot of a Douglas Sirk movie or a John Cheever story or something. The one divorced lady moves in and everyone else is just gasps at her effrontery.
She absolutely felt that way. And I did too, as a kid, feeling like I would hear that my friends and their parents had all gotten together at for some kind of fondue party and we weren't invited. And I think when my mom first moved in, some neighborly husband came over to help her carry some suitcase in, and he got a talking to, and you know, it really was a,
this is a Mad Men plotline. I just realized mom lived a season two Mad Men plotline.
Yeah, she sure did in more ways than one. She can't watch Mad Men because she thinks that she has all these problems with the continuity of their shoes or whatever. She lived through that whole period.
It's true that I'm very good at spotting anachronisms in movies of my period. Yeah. Like there were Reese's Pieces in some movie, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And I'm like, there were no Reese's Pieces in 1967.
But No Fault Divorce played a big role in my life. My parents were divorced when I was four. And at the time it was, I think, a radical and shocking. It was the only divorce really that had happened in my family.
Your family was living in Seattle at the time, or in Alaska?
We were in Alaska. Mm-hmm. My mom, dad, and my sister and I had moved to Alaska. And my mom didn't like Alaska, and she decided that she didn't like my dad. And my mom was someone who was very independent and self-starting. She taught herself computer programming and had taken a job as a computer programmer before I was born in the mid-60s, which really frustrated my dad, primarily because he didn't like the optics. He was a lawyer and felt like having his wife work reflected poorly on his ability and reflected poorly on his social standing.
That's not just him. That's very generational, yeah. I assume.
He was a prominent Seattle lawyer, and his wife shouldn't work. And my mom didn't work because she needed the money. She needed the intellectual exercise. You know, she was curious and she wanted to have her own autonomy out in the world.
But at the time, the assumption wouldn't have just been, oh, you got an independent wife there. It really would have been like, ooh, what's wrong that she has to work?
Either thing. I mean, I think the assumption would have been, oh, you got an independent wife there. What's wrong?
But it would not have necessarily been, oh, you can't pay the bills, huh?
No, although that was my dad's insecurity. And I think my mom did want control of her own money as part of her independence. It frustrated her that she didn't have control of her own accounts. But that wasn't my father being unusual. At the time, for a woman and a married woman to open her own bank account required that her husband co-sign.
Didn't we just talk about how credit cards could not be obtained?
She couldn't get a credit card without the sort of paternalistic approval of her husband. And in the case of my mom and my dad, she did go to him and grab him by the shirt collar and say, you will co-sign on this.
Yeah, I can't see your mom taking too much crap on financial lines.
And so she did have her own bank account, her own line of credit, her own checking account.
I mean, we can laugh at these frail male egos, but this still happens today in marriages where the other spouse makes more. Yeah. I feel like many, many people who think of themselves as broad-minded, modern liberal people still suddenly, deep in their heart of hearts, feel very threatened when their paycheck is smaller.
Well, it's super challenging in our contemporary society when one spouse, kind of regardless of gender, has more power and more income, but gender certainly amplifies it. It's always a challenge unless your income and status in the world is configured with your desire to be a submissive or dominant member of the partnership, right? If you're like... Spank me, daddy. Also, I make less money. It all works well.
That's not a sentence you hear very often. I have two things to say. First, spank me. Second, my earning potential is quite low.
But if you know,
I've been very bad and financially reliant.
In circumstances where the desire, the mutual desire or desire of one party or the other to have a marriage that's founded in equality.
I feel like that's kind of the nominal assumption now.
And that was maybe absolutely not the assumption.
I know, like it's a surprisingly modern thing. You'd think that would be, you know, just a fair place to start in all cases. And
but astonishingly modern in by which I mean modern into the last decade. It was not until 2010 that the state of New York allowed two people to divorce one another based on a mutual desire to be divorced.
They were the last state to have no fault divorce.
New York State was the last state that did not require that one party prove wrongdoing,
demonstrate some cause,
or that both parties live in a state of legal separation for a period of time. 18 months or a year, or you know, the term was reduced over time, but still never less than 6 months to prove to the government that you genuinely wanted to be apart. And that kind of legal requirement is sort of the writ large version of it confirms that the idea that a partnership would be one that was designed around mutual assent, and when that mutual assent was no longer shared, that you could have a mutual consent to dissolve it without needing to prove anything. That's pretty new.
Yes, and future listeners should be aware that that's the universe that you and I grew up in,
right?
And probably everybody our age or younger just takes it as granted that that's how marriage and divorce should work. If one party's out, it's over.
Right.
And that has really never happened before in the history of the world before the 20th century, and in America until the late 20th century.
Right. Well, and really globally, there was a sense in the 19th century, pretty much globally up until that point, there was no concept of certainly no no-fault divorce, but really not a ton of just like the legalistic divorce, right? Within the Catholic Church, there was no divorce. Within most religious traditions, there was a sense of marriage being a bond that transcended your whim or even transcended abuse that you might suffer, it was only in the 19th century.
Yeah, we didn't treat it, even in places where it was a secular institution as well as a religious one, it was not just treated as equivalent to any other contract, right, where, you know, the parties had certain rights to bail. No, it was something much more foundational and ironclad than that.
And it was in the 19th century that the secularization of government really started to be more commonplace. I mean, up until then, 18th century, mostly governments were still ruled.
They had state religions.
State religion.
Yeah.
And so the idea of divorce really became sort of a sense of that there was legal divorce was popular, and that there could be accommodations made with the religious authorities. That even is fairly recent. It wasn't, I mean, the first attempt at writing in a notion of divorce as a mutual assent wasn't until Frederick the Great was trying to modernize Prussia and trying to sort of describe himself as a or rather try to rule his country according to Enlightenment principles.
Right. I'm not one of those mean old-timey kings that does whatever. Like, we've got a system that makes sense now.
Right. And one of those, as he reformed or attempted to reform the whole system of laws that govern Prussia, he wrote in, or it was written into these laws, that the idea that you could divorce someone based on mutual assent.
But if he's jumping ahead of every other country on earth, I mean, that must have been some idea that thinkers have been tossing around. Like, wouldn't it be better if religion wasn't mean and made you do stuff like this?
And this was true across everything sort of during the Enlightenment period, where where government was being separated from religious authority, separated from kings that had the right of gods, and turned into civil matters. But you encountered an awful lot of resistance. And even as other things became secularized, the institution of marriage, a lot of the power of marriage, the symbolic power of it, and also the social power of it, was that it was meant to survive a lot of slings and arrows, right? You could be extremely dissatisfied in a marriage, but it wouldn't be grounds to dissolve the marriage, because
a lot of those assumptions probably have children in mind.
100%. I mean, marriage being primarily to foster
the child rearing implement,
rearing children,
stability for them.
You couldn't just dissolve a marriage, even if you suffered for decades, because you had the state and the church had a vested interest in children being cared for by an intact family. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a movement in favor of divorce. It was an institution that would have required an overwhelming event to try and undermine or destabilize. And the first time that we really saw it happen was during the Russian Revolution, in the aftermath of the revolution.
So one way to stick it to religion,
that's right,
and to secularize a new atheist society is to say, hey, like we wouldn't design a contract this way.
It required nothing less than a revolution,
violent
scale.
Overthrow. Yeah,
and even then, although divorce was introduced in the sort of the Bolshevik constitution, they didn't think it all the way through, and there wasn't any component of alimony or
sure. It's still going to be a bunch of men who are like, wait, what's going to happen now?
Right. The provision for the spouse that had no money. The lack of provision for it meant that you could write no-fault divorce into the law, but that was effectively, it just was a law that allowed men to cast out their wives.
Yeah, one of the exes would be penniless.
So it then became a legal puzzle, because with the greater secularization of society, even in the West, it was recognized like this needed, particularly when women got the franchise to vote, throughout the 20th century, there was a sense that there needed to be a different system that conformed to our growing notion that women had autonomy, and that marriage was not something that the state had an interest in characterizing as a contract in perpetuity, right? It was, if you were going to have individual rights under the law, you couldn't bind people in this way.
Right. Any other contract would have an out, right?
Right.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works. This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
In Maoist China, they introduced sort of no-fault divorce in the 50s. But again, within a communist context, and one where the state is functioning as the ultimate authority at a much greater level.
I assume you'll probably get to this, but I assume in the U.S., one of the things that led to the recognition this was not working was the fact that divorces were happening, but it had to happen with some kind of charade of fault to get around the current laws, right?
So divorce evolved over the course of the 20th century to become more and more commonplace, but it did require the assigning of blame. And that required that one partner either commit a felony or adultery or abandonment or some
abuse,
within a very narrow description of what constituted enough.
Not everything we would consider abusive today by a long chalk was probably grounds for divorce then.
Right. And that that it had to be proved, and not just an accusation, but it had to be demonstrated, which meant that in
by some legal standard of preponderance of the evidence, you'd have to show that there was
not only that, but that if you were accused within a divorce proceeding of adultery, and your response to it, let's say you were a husband and your wife accused you of adultery, if you said to the judge in response, well, she also committed adultery, the fact that you were defending yourself with what was called a defense of recrimination, which is basically to say, you know,
they
well, I was bad, but you were bad too. In an instance like that, judges would rule that your marriage was dysfunctional, but that was not grounds to dissolve it.
Because there's no wronged party.
Right.
If both people are the wronged party. That's weird.
So if you did not want to be divorced and your spouse was accusing you of malfeasance, all you needed to do was find a way in which they were culpable in the malfeasance, and that defense of recrimination was enough to keep the marriage together.
Two people who both wanted to be divorced, if there's mutual assent, would put on a little show.
Well, now this became the problem, right? Because yes, if both parties wanted out of the marriage, one of them needed to take the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so
were there legal consequences to discourage that kind of a thing?
No, if you were,
person who's taking the fall gets no other penalty besides here's a divorce.
By the 1950s and 60s, if you were judged by the court to have committed adultery, there was no additional punishment for adultery mm-hmm. associated with it. It was just that your spouse then was granted a divorce, but that there was some assumption that they were an injured party. And so
the decision about assets and support would take that into account.
Right. But there were a lot of workarounds.
In old movies, they're always going to Reno.
Well,
what was the Nevada law that made that more workable?
So Nevada had a law that if you lived in Nevada for 6 weeks, you could gain residency in Nevada, at which point Nevada would grant you a divorce where a lot of other states wouldn't. So you'd move to Nevada.
They didn't have no-fault divorce, but they had some kind of shorter waiting period, some kind of shorter separation period required, or less demonstration of whatever the cause is.
Right. And if one party moved to Nevada and lived there for 6 weeks, they could then file for divorce in Nevada, and they had to prove a lot less wrongdoing.
Smart tourism move.
It was. Nevada and Mexico actually were two places that people went.
All those depraved Californians just coming and spending money just so they can get a divorce.
But in New York, there was a solution to it, which was called collusive adultery, where they would...
I want to try collusive adultery.
Somebody would hire a private detective. They would get a woman to pose as the mistress. The man and the woman would be caught in flagrante delicto.
How flagrante does the delicto have to be? Does the guy get to?
I don't think it has to. It could, you know.
Maybe he gets too into character.
Viewer discretion is advised. And then, you know, then the private detective with the wife in tow bursts down the door, and it's and then, you know, that is sufficient evidence then to take to court.
And does the judge know that everybody's making a mockery of his courtroom because they're all insisting that this actually happened, but he knows that in 9 out of 10 cases?
Yes. And what ended up happening was that the American Bar Association and a lot of the legal institutions of the country started to feel that this divorce charade was making a mockery of oaths and of the legal system, because
all the lawyers are having to cover up for this.
Everybody is pretending, but people are saying under oath things that everyone knows to be untrue.
You're normalizing perjury.
And it was actually a fear of normalizing perjury that caused the Bar Association and the American legal community to start to advocate for a liberalization of divorce law.
That's crazy. Because what we would think is the fact that this charade is going on in massive amounts is a sign that the underlying law is wrong and not addressing the actual social needs.
And I think that it was the reflective conclusion, right? The law is wrong, but what's driving us to consider it is that at least that generation of lawyers still believed that there was something that the law was sacrosanct, or the practice was, you don't get up and swear an oath. Perjure yourself.
It's a professional indignity.
Yeah. I mean, now we live in a world where people are perjuring themselves right and left, and the burden of proof, or rather the burden of effort of just prosecuting someone for perjury seems so much more difficult. But people went to jail for perjury until not very long ago for perjuring themselves in small matters because the courts regarded themselves as temples.
Well, if you remember the Clinton impeachment, the perjury turned out to be a bigger deal than the possible adultery. I can't remember whether oral sex is adultery in that jurisdiction or not. But it occurred to me that in some quarters, even if you realized that this massive charade showed that, that the law was not representing everybody's interest, you might be okay with that if you thought, well, anybody who wants a divorce for frivolous reasons, is a party whose interest we should not be catering to. Like, society needs to make these people, should not take their wishes into account, or should make them jump through hoops, because the greater good is not represented by these dingbats who want a divorce. If you have strong feelings about the dangers of what divorce represents.
Well, but the flip side, of course, is that making people jump through hoops to get divorces means that people are going to invent all kinds of, they're going to make false accusations. There's going to be a lot of lying happening that maybe isn't intrinsic to the situation, but is the only kind of solution. Like, for instance, the reason that there are periods of legal separation rather than just like, okay, you know what? I can't live with you anymore. I'm going to move to an apartment over here and you stay here and we'll work it out.
I assumed it was like a gun waiting list where you don't want people to impulsively do something they'll regret.
Well, it's that, but also
something permanent.
If you just move out and don't get a legal separation, that's grounds to accuse you of desertion, which was one of the handful of reasons to be granted a divorce. So if you want to live apart but don't want to be found in fault as a deserter, you acquire a legal separation. And that sets in motion a kind of clock where you can live apart, still married, but be on the path to arriving at a divorce conclusion.
This happened prior to straight up no-fault divorce laws. No-fault divorce would be allowed after a certain period of legal separation.
Well, yeah, but the rolling out of no-fault divorce happened over the course of 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
In 1969, California became the first state to enact no-fault divorce.
The weird thing to me is Reagan is governor, right?
Reagan signed the law because Reagan was was divorced.
Oh, like, I guess that's true.
Reagan had divorced Mary Pickford or whatever and married Nancy. And so he felt some simpatico.
I'm pretty sure it was not Mary Pickford.
Or whatever.
It's Jane Wyman.
Jane Wyman.
It's true. We've only had two divorced presidents, and they have not been from the sexually depraved party. What's
that's
going
right.
on?
Well, it's just like Nixon goes to China. Only the Republicans get to be divorced.
And is that why he did it? He had some inner sympathy for the plight of what divorcees go through, the sincere, well-meaning mass of American divorcees?
Reagan became more and more conservative over time as he saw that was the path to power. I think in the 50s, he was a Democrat, and in the 60s, I think he was a cocktail party going Nelson Rockefeller Republican.
And the Christian right had not really arisen as a powerful force.
It wasn't.
So that wouldn't have been a motivating, that would not have been a motivating thing to his political outlook is what God-fearing men and women want from their government.
And this was in the winds, right? In 1969 we were now we were long past the dawn, but we were now in the kind of early center of the women's rights movement, but also we were a half a dozen years past the advent of the pill and the arrival of the pill and the liberation that enabled within wives to determine whether or not they were going to reproduce. It had a cascading effect in all these spheres of recognizing female autonomy and
right.
And empowerment.
If sex is synonymous with childbearing and family to you, then of course everyone's going to have sex, which right. means, everyone's going to have a family with kids, and the law should reflect that assumption about the universality and permanence of that. And as soon as those things get dissociated, it's a whole different set of assumptions.
Right. Sex isn't just procreative, and what that also sparked was this sexual revolution. And so it created... There were a lot of undercurrents in no-fault divorce in its early days. Men, husbands, typically were pretty excited about it because they no longer had to prove that their wife had been unfaithful. They could just find a younger wife. And so early feminists, including the National Organization for Women, came out against it in a lot of jurisdictions, because without alimony.
Right, that's a legal protection for the.
Right. And alimony was always tied to the finding of fault, because it was presumed that the woman who didn't earn an income had done nothing wrong, and so was owed support as she got back on her feet. But in a no-fault situation, it wasn't automatic an understanding that she should be supported as she found a career.
I mean, that's a feminist critique of no-fault divorce that probably still holds today.
It does.
It gives men a lot of power to discard wives for newer, younger, more exciting models, which is something that we see in model of wife, not fashion model, which is something that we see a lot in society.
We do, and it's part of the kind of feminization of poverty that we've seen in a lot of ways in the aftermath of no-fault divorce, which is that we just see more and more single women with an income inequality but kind of baked into the culture,
yeah,
and often arriving in the world as someone who was, who didn't have her own job and now has children and received no recompense.
Through the American lens, it's hard to do the thought experiment and think what would be better or worse in our society if we had not tried the no-fault divorce experiment in all 50 states. But in fact, many other countries continue to not treat divorce the same way.
This was true. Australia didn't enact no-fault divorce until 1975. Canada didn't allow no-fault divorce, and even that with a lot of restrictions, until 1986.
I know in South Korea, when I was growing up, there's to this day, there's not no-fault divorce.
Right.
Spouses have to demonstrate, you have to make the case to the state. Maybe it's not as strict as what it would have been in 1930s America, abuse, abandonment, infidelity, but something along those lines to convince the state that you're allowed to get a divorce. And I think the United Kingdom has a similar thing. You got to make a case to the crown.
They do. And you have to have a period of legal separation. You have to demonstrate that you're not going to reconcile.
So it's clear that these are two workable systems that, have their strengths and weaknesses in the realities of modern life and, sexual parity between men and women. It's not like no-fault divorce is the new feminist-friendly model.
No.
And
now continued to fight it, even as other sort of feminist thinkers made a very compelling case that after the introduction of no-fault divorce, female suicide declined by 15%. After the introduction of no-fault divorce,
abuse went down, right?
Domestic violence was reduced by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with fault divorce is a lot of times people in abusive relationships are, when they're required to stand up in court and testify against their abuser, they find themselves very inhibited.
Yeah, there's a class of people for whom you really want to lower the barriers to ending a marriage because it's obviously in the public good for them to get away from their abusers, but it's so difficult to do. And of course, you can't coerce it.
So California put this, you know, this no-fault divorce into the books in 1969, and then other states started to trickle along. By 1977, 9 states had no-fault divorce laws. There's an organization, and we've never really talked about it on the program, but they play a pretty large role in American public life. That's called the Uniform Law Commission, which
is the deep state.
It's sort of a deep state.
The ULC.
It dates back to the 19th century, and it's a voluntary commission that has representatives from all 50 states. And the intended purpose of the ULC is that as states start to pass laws that have similar intents, that it makes sense for American states to come together and work out the wording of laws so that we don't have 50 laws that are mostly the same.
Because it's kind of insane that we have these 50 semi-autonomous governments anyway, under one federal legal code.
So if we're all going to decide that, you know, at the state level, we're going to allow divorce, we should have that worded more or less the same. So people aren't moving to Nevada for 6 weeks and getting divorced. And so the Universal Law Commission came out with, in 1969, this proposal, the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, and, you know, with the idea that it would become a kind of template for what no-fault divorce was going to look like. But it wasn't until 1983 that almost all states had adopted some form of a law permitting divorce by mutual assent. The only two holdouts were South Dakota and the aforementioned New York State, and New York didn't allow
hard to see a trend there.
2010, right?
I can't think of two places less likely. You'd think that that cosmopolitan New York City. It's weird to think that was the one jurisdiction where marriages were still being held together in a way that no other state would allow.
Well, New York, like, weirdly has a pretty long tradition of being really conservative on marriage issues. New York State New York State still actually has a law against adultery. It's not widely enforced, but you can be convicted of adultery in New York.
That's always weird to me because it just means that, you know, that could be wielded any number of ways. Sure. You know, as long as that's on the books, it may not be enforced, fairly.
Well, until 1966, adultery was the only grounds for divorce in New York. Even cruelty, which other states allowed as a ground for divorce, was not a grounds in New York. You could prove that your spouse was cruel, and New York was like, sorry, you know what?
That's marriage, actually.
There are quite a few states now that have no-fault divorce and at-fault divorce, both as potential routes toward divorce, and New York is one of those states. I think about a third of American states are only no-fault. They've abolished at-fault divorce entirely.
It's a recognition that, I guess, the legal path should be the same.
Right. But I think at-fault divorce is still very common. And a lot of it has to do with apportionment of alimony. Now, there are 7 American states, and Washington is one of them, that are community property states,
right,
which sort of alleviate the question of equitable distribution of marriage assets and just say everything that you own together in the marriage.
The marriage owns it.
Is split in half at dissolution of the marriage. So that ultimately is, I think, the natural and ultimate consequence of no-fault divorce, which is, yeah, you guys get divorced. Everything that you own in common is shared unless otherwise negotiated, right? You can get married and have a prenuptial agreement that changes the rules.
That trumps community property.
I think if you sign a prenup before you get married, there are states like the state of Alaska is a community property state, but that's an opt-in. So at the start of the marriage, you can either opt in or not.
Can either spouse opt in? I assume both spouses have to opt in.
I think it's a thing where you have to high five it as you go in, or at the dissolution of the divorce, you make a separate arrangement.
It just makes sense. If the marriage is any length at all, you have to imagine a parallel universe where, it's like making up a call in football, Who knows what would have happened if the call had gone the other way? Coaching decisions would have been different. Well, in the same way, it's hard to just say what financial outcomes would have been if a marriage had not happened. So, splitting the baby 50-50 seems like it makes more sense than trying to guess what everybody's earning power would have been or what they deserve.
Right. But there's always that argument where it's like, I went to college and became a stockbroker and all my wife did was make toasted cheese sandwiches and that's my money.
Right. But part of her decision to stick in making toasted cheese instead of thinking of, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
The referee has to say,
and that's, that's determined often. And in a lot of cases in the majority of American states, still determined by the judge. There are a lot of alimony rules that very much are dependent on how long you were married. If you were married for less than 3 years, a lot of states won't grant alimony. There are a lot of states that grant alimony for a very fixed period. You only receive alimony for 3 to 5 years after the marriage, and
it's a little starter thing.
Yeah, well, and some of
get
that
your own life going.
Some of that argument is that to receive perpetual alimony is keeps you from beginning a new life. I mean, there are so many.
I guess I can see that too. If for a very short marriage, decades and decades of alimony and perpetuity.
Right. It's basically you have a government pension. You retired from the Air Force is what that's like. The state of Texas, I think, says that you can receive as alimony either $2,500 or 40% of your spouse's gross, whichever is less per month.
I feel like a remarriage often will end alimony.
Remarriage ends alimony.
And I've often thought a funny business idea or a, comedy premise would be, some spouse trying to get his ex remarried, his or her ex remarried, to end the payment of alimony. And then, of course, then the two really fall in love. You see?
Oh,
you see how this is going to work in my little Netflix rom-com?
I love it. Of course, alimony is separate from child support. And states have states do enforce child support, but a lot of times now, increasingly, where the female partner makes more money and is more prominent than the man, you have this new, really new idea of male alimony. In most cases, up until very recently,
galimony maybe.
Galimony.
It's paid by the gal. Should we try that?
I don't know. No. You want to let that roll?
Mm.
In most cases where the male partner earned less and was less prominent up until very recently, they would those alimony situations were usually in the form of a cash payout, like when Britney Spears divorced Kevin Federline, like he got some bag of money
after his 5 week duty or whatever.
Yeah, but it wasn't a thing where he collected alimony. That wouldn't have made his next career as a hip hop dancer seem very cool. But I think now more and more you're seeing actual alimony paid to whichever spouse it is that makes less money.
Have you always wanted to learn to play an instrument? Maybe you've even tried at some point, but gave up because you felt lessons were too expensive or that you just didn't have the time. Thankfully, there's Musician. Musician is the fun, easy, and affordable way to learn guitar, piano, bass, ukulele, and even singing. Just download the app to your desktop, tablet, or phone and start playing. Musician gives you 24/7 access to a vast catalog of video lessons from professionally trained educators, as well as thousands of exercises and songs across dozens of music genres, all tailored to your goals. And with Musician's award-winning technology that listens to you play, you'll get real-time feedback on timing and accuracy so you can actually see yourself improving as you learn. Start your extended 14-day free trial of Musician's Premium Plus package at musician.com/start. That's unlimited access to thousands of lessons, exercises, and songs on as many instruments as you want for 2 whole weeks. Just go to musician.com/start. That's YOUSICIAN.com/start.
Now, maybe you're going to get to this, but I assume that a lot of the modern culture wars over marriage, which have centered on rights to same-sex marriage largely, don't they often have side skirmishes that relate to relitigating no-fault divorce? Like, wasn't this the real assault on marriage stability? Because divorce rates did go up, right?
Divorce rates went up in the short term.
Yeah, divorce rates peaked, I think, in the early 90s and have been coming down since.
But really, like, divorce is...
I know when Scotland legalized no-fault divorce, there was a spike, and that was all the people who maybe should have gotten divorced for years that it had been building up.
And that's what happened in the U.S. states, too, that divorce rates are actually lower.
Yeah.
Because there aren't all these...
I guess you could make the argument that there's other impediments to marriage that are keeping frivolous marriages down in a way that they wouldn't have before.
Well, and there aren't so many arranged marriages or assumed marriages, and all of
or
this
we
goes,
got pregnant marriages.
Yeah, all of it goes along with birth control, yeah. Also. But yeah, when no fault divorce is initially enacted in a place, yeah, you see a divorce or a divorce spike. But in general, divorce rates remain more or less constant and kind of on the decline, actually, surprisingly. So the institution of marriage survives against all odds, Ken. I can't account for it.
It's kind of nice. I recommend it.
Marriage.
If anyone out there is living in a society without marriage and wants to just give it a shot and can find a like-minded jellyfish or bumblebee person or whatever, I recommend marriage. It's a delight.
Well, you and I are
married.
You and I are married in spirit. We have a life bond. No, you and I are a great example of a very, very small anecdotal control group. You are married, uh-huh. And I am not.
You are never married.
And so let's see which one of us lives longer and prospers. The futurelings will know.
This is going to decide it.
1,000 years from now, they'll be like, marriage.
Ken outlived John, so
the Jennings
route? It must have been super good.
In my mind,
there will probably be Jenningsites and Roderickites.
Yeah,
with opposing views on marriage.
You had two kids, and at least thus far, I've only had one. So there will probably be more Jenningses than there will be Rodericks. Although I may have more acolytes.
Yeah, exactly. You'll have
who change their name.
You'll have spiritual children.
In my mom's case, she credits no-fault divorce with her own ability to strike out in the world on her own. She did not have to prove emotional cruelty or adultery or anything of the kind with my dad. She was able to divorce him with a no-fault.
But in a generation that, you know, doesn't have all the advances that were happening at that time, let's say in a generation like ours that already has a good deal more equity between the sexes, obviously not perfect, but a good deal more, does a no-fault divorce have such a, is it such a game changer for women today? I guess it could be.
I think it is on the path. I mean, we see now a rise in the sort of father's rights movement, which,
right, a lot of assumptions about who gets
The courts
custody
are, the courts make all kinds of decisions that favor the mother in almost every kind of custody dispute, and there are states like Washington that have different laws, and in depending on how you look at the father's rights movement, maybe more progressive laws in Washington about what rights a father has to play a role in their child's upbringing. all of this is a long path, right? My mom liked the opportunity that no-fault divorce provided her, and then immediately stepped out into a world where a woman couldn't have a freaking credit card without her husband co-signing on it.
So she's ahead of the curve.
So she had to fight a lot of battles that
no fault divorce didn't solve all her problems.
And now a younger generation, people now would find some of those battles kind of hard to conceive of being in such recent memory as they are. But there are a lot more battles to fight in terms of, people continue to get married, although you could make an argument that it's a strange institution with an awful lot of baggage across a whole spectrum of, it's like Christmas trees, basically. Like what is
the fact that it does survive though? It must mean it reflects something deep in us. And, I guess for a while, the only way we could think of to structure a family, but if not that, at least a very, a time-tested and maybe by the numbers fortuitous way to start one.
Well, it not only survives, but it flourishes. I mean, it is the primary aspirational event in a whole lot of different alternate family structures.
I read as many bridal magazines as you do. I know how aspirational, that kind of thing is.
But the same-sex marriage became maybe one of, if not the focal point of
a real pivot for the gay rights movement. Not to say we disdain these old-fashioned institutions, but you know what? We're going to play along. We would like to benefit by them as well.
And I think now in the 2010s, as the culture gets accustomed to the fact that, gay people are also going to get divorced, and you don't get to, and that's not proof of anything.
There's going to be no postage stamp or statues of the first gay divorcees.
Right. I mean, but to have like gay marriage legal in 50 states is to also have no fault divorce between gay people. And that is not proof that gay marriage doesn't work.
Right.
It's just
parody.
It's just marriage, man.
And that concludes No Fault Divorce. Entry 840.MK1009, certificate number 27256, in the omnibus. Now, futurelings, we of course you do not have social media, you don't have access to it, but if there's an archive of social media of our time, you can certainly see the combined writings of both John and myself. Jenningsites should look for support for the idea of marriage. Roderickites should look to for the freewheeling, independent rock and roll lifestyle of their idol. You can find all of the above at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick on Twitter and or Instagram. We are jointly at Omnibus Project everywhere else, and the project is agnostic on marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Omnibus Project is neither married nor single. It exists in a state of quantum indeterminacy between the two.
Quantum indeterminacy again.
Until you open the box, the cat is both married and single.
I want to see the alternate universe where I got married when I was 24. I definitely want to see the alternate universe where I got married at 28. That would have been a hilarious marriage.
But I do not want to see any kind of marriage where any kind of universe where I was not
where
married.
You didn't get married to Mindy.
Because I'd be a disaster. Oh, you know,
that's absolutely true. Like she nothing 80% like 80% of like what clues you together.
Can you imagine like just some like tech guy?
I'm trying to picture it. You're like derp, derp, derp.
I think Mindy and I often wonder if I would have ever gone on the quiz show.
Oh really?
If not for her good advice and sensible support, because in a community property state like Washington, it's irrelevant. She still gets half the winnings.
Yeah, right.
But is she entitled? Maybe so.
Well, the thing about Mindy is that although she kind of cosplays as just like a cheerful Mormon mom, she's way darker and cooler than you. And so she just has the vibe of someone that would be cool even if she were in a different community.
I don't like the premise that cheerful Mormon mommy bloggers are not cool. Like that's the ultimate cool to me.
I know, but she also is a little goth, and it's why Caitlin is so goth.
Do not say Caitlin. Do not tell Caitlin she is goth.
Oh, I'm sorry, Caitlin.
She has black fingernails right now.
But
if I make a single goth joke, she gets very angry.
Caitlin, as an external observer, I have seen a lot of goths in my life. I've watched a lot of people go goth and then go back, and you are pretty goth.
I guess what you never want to do is suggest that any tween or teen is all their style choices are part of a movement or trend, because
anyone ever did it before.
They all just come from their sincere soul, and how can you try to classify?
You're absolutely right. But Mindy is goth, and I don't know if she would admit that, but she is. It's just in the way she looks at things.
Huge Cure fan. I don't know if that's a soul determining factor.
If you show her something that she thinks is lame, the way she communicates how lame she thinks it is super goth.
Would one of those things be your freewheeling rock and roll lifestyle? Is that one of the things you're thinking of here?
A little bit. When she shoos me out of the house with a broom, like, shoo, shoo. I'm like, look, I'm Ken's cool friend.
You can send us all your opinions on marriage and divorce, which we will read. If you want us to adjudicate any marriage issues, we are happy to do that. Just send them to us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
I am super here for that.
Is that right? Do your friends come to you with questions about their marriages?
I have a podcast called Roadwork with Dan Benjamin, and as part of our...
It's a great show. You should listen if it survives to your...
As part of our Patreon, we have an after-show Patreon-only show every week where we respond to viewer mail, and it's often very personal mail, and a lot of people write us about their relationships and about ethical quandaries, and it's behind a paywall because we talk about stuff in a way that I don't think we would want.
You don't
want
to get canceled.
World. Well, it's not that. It's that I don't want Pitchfork or
right. This is not general advice.
It's not general advice, and it's not there for looky-loos or people who are just looking for problems to kind of swing in, not understanding the context of the show.
Unless they pay you money. And then they can do it.
I feel like
they can swing it.
I feel like even a dollar a month is a burden that someone looking for problems isn't going to pay just to find problems.
It's like no fault divorce.
That's right.
You need to create some low barrier to entry to,
yeah,
because of the state's interest in not having looky loos.
If you're paying a dollar a month, you're already so much more invested than most people. Anyway, so I talk about this stuff quite a bit.
Nobody asks me for advice on their marriages, and I appreciate that.
Well, you don't, you know, you are not goth.
I feel like my unoffered advice is generally that people with kids are a little too casual about decisions about their marriage, and people without kids are not casual enough. Like, honestly, people without kids should get divorced more, and people with kids should get divorced less.
Yeah, that's the Ken Jennings doctrine.
Jennings' law. you can send us physical items. This does not have to be related to the state of your marriage, but anything you would like to send us, we would be happy to take a look at it. The Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
If you are mad at your spouse and you want to take something that's very precious to them and mail it to us, sure. I'll take it.
If they listen to the show, they may hear us unwrap it, though.
Yeah. And be like, oh, wow, look at this Longines watch that is engraved to someone's dad. Cool.
I did not mention the Futurelings who congregate on Facebook and to a much lesser degree on Reddit.
Well, don't say that. You're just going to make Redditors mad and then they're going to dox you.
The only thing I want in the world is to make Redditors mad.
I know. They get mad pretty easily.
Speaking of people who will never be married, Redditors.
They're so mad.
They're super mad right now. If you have not been through a costly divorce and wish to celebrate that fact financially.
Oh, I thought you meant and wish to approximate that.
Yeah. If you're not making it out, take the size of the largest alimony payment you would make,
yep,
and proffer it to a good cause like the Omnibus Project. And we will continue this fine and important time capsule of our era. You can do that. You can make that financial pledge at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, back in these archaic and medieval times where people still don't just get to be who they are without having aspects of their identity imposed upon them by the courts and the cultures and the banks.
I still cannot marry a corporation.
Nope.
I cannot marry six octopuses.
Nope.
I can't marry a fire engine.
I am a vampire, and I still cannot see myself in the mirror.
You really can't.
No. And
you blame the courts?
Is that intrinsic to vampirism? I don't think so. Who decides?
I don't know what the legal remedy to that would be, but okay.
We want our civilization to survive long enough to create a network of institutions that allow your civilization to flourish based on the hard choices and the bad decisions and the fan fictions and the alternate universes where Alexander invaded Rome.
Learn from our mistakes.
And so that's why, partly why we're recording all of this, so that you know all the struggles and you don't have to repeat those struggles.
They all led up to our demise. So basically, if there's anything we did, don't do it.
Futurelings may, of course, look back and go, actually, no fart divorce. That's the hardest one to live. No, no fault divorce actually was the beginning of the end, and we they realized that shoring up the institution of marriage and making it impossible to get out of a marriage was the thing that saved
them. So it was Reagan's fault, just like we all said. We were just wrong about the specifics.
All of the future, like, hyper political algae mats who are like wearing whip inflation now buttons.
Where did they get them?
I don't know, man. They're floating in the Sargasso Sea.
Yeah, all the floating plastic vortex or whatever. Right.
It became sentient. Gyre.
Yeah, its whirlings resembled the synapses of a brain, and the next thing you know, the trash patch is thinking.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear that results in a hyper-intelligent trash patch may never come. Although we don't, if it's a trash patch listening to the show.
Hey, what's up?
We're happy for you.
Carbon Life, don't listen to this. Trash Patch, hello.
Trash Patch, did you understand the Hilbert Hotel entry? Because I didn't. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.